If you're focused on executive or business leadership, there's always the chance that leadership has become dysfunctional. The real question is, if it's dysfunctional, is it really leadership at all? We're going to have a discussion about that. Join us in just a moment.
You're listening to Leadership Powered by Common Sense with your host, Doug Thorpe. Here's Doug.
Well, hello again, everyone. This is an episode of Leadership Powered by Common Sense. I am your host, Doug Thorpe. And today I have an incredibly interesting opportunity. For the first time in the show's history, I actually have two guests in the same spot. And not only are we doing that, but I have found a wonderful pair of experts that happen to be a mother-daughter duo. I will first introduce Anne DeSantaris.
Dranitzaris.
I knew I was going to butcher that. I am so sorry. Dranitzaris.
No worries.
We practiced, and I shake the shot right out of the tube. How about that? And her daughter, Heather Dranitzaris Hilliard. There we go. I got awesome. That one. Yay. Ladies, welcome.
Thank you, Doug. Thanks for having us on the show. Excited to be here.
Good. Well, we're really looking forward to it. So we are going to talk about the notion of how leadership can become dysfunctional. But before we really get into that, I'm dying to hear the backstory from both of you, really. How have you had your journey and how do you get to this this place you are today? Who wants to go first?
I'll start.
Okay, great.
So Anne and I, as a mother-daughter team, we've been in business together now for 24 years. It came about interestingly because we have a little bit of a different backstory in that Anne gave me up for adoption when she had me, just shy of her 17th birthday. And we reconnected and reunited, as they call it, when I was 27 years old. And within the span of about 3.5 years, we sort of realized just how much work we were doing in a similar way, her individually and myself in organizations, that we sort of naturally moved towards launching our own business together. And we've been working with leaders and with organizations ever since.
Oh my goodness, what a story.
Yes, it's been quite a journey. And just to add to that, Heather and I have come from, despite having the same interests in helping people and organizations achieve their potential, I came at it from a one-on-one leadership coaching, psychological background, where Heather came at it more from the more traditional consulting and systems and performance and compensation and other systems and organizations. And we realized very early in our conversations together that if you had one or the other, you were going to have an imbalance. And by putting the two of them together, both people and systems, then it gave leaders and organizations a much better chance to achieve the results that they were going for.
That's phenomenal. And, there are so many leadership training programs that get into all the elements that you're describing. And on one end of the spectrum is definitely the body of work that I call, for lack of a better word, the psycho-emotional aspects of leadership, where you really try to get into the mindsets and the human interaction. And even modern now, that's where we talk about emotional intelligence and some of the brain science that's being delivered. But then you work through that spectrum and you get to the more system-oriented, qualitative, quantitative assessment, evaluation, and implementation. And somewhere buried in all that is ideas like building a leadership framework, creating a culture, setting up accountability, coaching employees, developing leaders, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I like that blend.
Yeah, what we found was that in the work that I was doing with my clients, where we were trying to get change in behavior and change in performance, and we were coming at it purely from the systems lens, the consulting firm that I was with at the time, we didn't do anything behavioral or developmental. It was, we went in, identified the issue, and I built them a system and then helped them to roll it out and then said, good luck to them. And what we found was it wasn't getting the traction because there wasn't that aspect of moving the leaders along with it. And so we could build it, but it didn't mean they were ready to actually work the system as it was intended to be worked. And so that was, it was really interesting when Anne was talking about the work that she did individually with clients and for all the work she would do with them behaviorally and developmentally, they would go back to their organizations that lacked the systems in order for them to often apply the skills that they were developing through the coaching process. And that was that light bulb moment of, hey, what if we integrate the two and we work together to, you know, sort of, or at the organizational level, at the individual level, at the systems level, and that behavior level. And that's the traction that we've been able to get with our clients because we can work on at both of those aspects. We get far better results than we ever did without combining the two pieces, for sure.
Very interesting. Yeah, I can see that. So let me ask you, Anne, since you're more of, and boy, I'm going to make some generalized statements and I'll probably regret it when I do, but since you're more of the traditional executive coach frame is what I'm hearing, how have you tried to approach individual leaders and organizations about the need to have you help them do this work with the leaders?
I guess it's in a really non-traditional way, because in early days, Heather and I worked very hard to blend our skill sets so that it wasn't one thing or another, because I wasn't getting the traction when I first started leadership coaching, because I didn't know how to put that system in to support the accountability for the changing in behaviors. And if it wasn't done within a context or within a system, middle management in particular really struggled with, I've learned all these new skills, I want to try it and I want to practice it. And they would go back and their senior leaders would sort of poo-poo it and not really support their development because they weren't doing anything. And so because I started coaching, because when coaching really wasn't as big as it is right now. I started leadership coaching back in the late 1980s. And I just realized that in my psychotherapy practice, most of my clients were coming in complaining about leaders. So I decided that if I was going to really, I was really going to have an impact, I had to help the leaders to change their behavior towards employees. You know, and it was during that transition that I started making some inroads into organizations in a larger way. But for the most part, coaching done without a support system, it just doesn't get the traction. People can change some of their behavior, but it doesn't happen in a way that really eliminates organizational dysfunction that Heather and I tend to tackle together, coming at it from both sides.
Yeah, I can really relate to that. You know, your comment about in the early days of your practice not getting the traction you had hoped for. I'll tell you a quick little story. When I announced my pivot from what had been a consulting practice to a coaching practice, I arranged a dinner with a very good friend of mine who's a well-seasoned CEO. He's been a venture capital and private equity turnaround CEO, and he's done 6 or 8 companies in his career. Phenomenal guy, one of the sharpest executive leaders I've probably ever met. Both on a technical and on a personal level. And you just get motivated talking to this guy. I mean, you can't avoid it. He's just so dynamic that way. Anyway, so we're sitting there and I'm looking for this little bit of encouragement. I told him what my plan and idea was. He shook his head and he said, "You're going to fail." I said, "Whoa, what?" I said, "That's not what I was hoping to get out of this dinner."
Truly.
"What do you mean?" And he said, he said, well, you're telling me you're going to sell leadership and leadership training. And I go, yeah. He said, 5% of CEOs in the world understand leadership. And no more. I said, oh, that's severe. That can't be right. And he said, I promise you. He said, you can't lead with that. He said, you need to deliver that, but you can't lead with that. And I said, oh, okay, well, now let's elaborate. Let's talk about what you're saying here. And he then, you know, unpacked his whole strategy on how to get into companies and help them with team performance and overall, you know, growth and goal and achievement and execution. And he said, you've got to back into the leadership idea with these guys. So
it's we still find that today, right? And yeah. Then we often will talk about, you know, the in the conversations with clients or prospective clients, it's really understanding what's that burning platform, for lack of a better expression, but it's like, what are they complaining about? So if we look at what the CEO or what the senior executive team is spending all of their time complaining about, being frustrated about the issues that are sort of festering around and not getting resolved, that's often our starting point in the work with the clients to you know, find those places and what are the underlying root causes, because that's where the dysfunction lies, right? And in their, if they're complaining about it, it means they're not doing anything about it, because they're not equipped, they don't feel empowered to do something about it. And so that's often where we end up focusing a lot of our conversation. We don't lead in with a particular solution. We lead in with where does the organization want to get itself to? And again, because we ended up specializing in dysfunction, that is for most of our clients, they're very quick to be able to point out all of the things that are really frustrating them or causing them, causing the results not to be there, but also their experience of leading in their organizations, not the experience they want to be having either.
Yeah. Well, you know, Anne, when you talked about your therapy practice clients coming in complaining about their bosses, you know, there's the famous quote that says people join companies and quit bosses.
Yes, absolutely.
And boy, that's true. And in fact, just a side note for those listening that are hearing this for the first time, I actually have a campaign for 2020 that I call, you know, become a better boss. And I've got a
beautiful
personal challenge goal to contact and work with, or at least share information with 10,000 bosses to try to up their game and be better at that game, so that they're not seeing the exodus out on the work floor. So let's be specific. Let's define this dysfunction that gets evidenced in the workplace. Just what are some of the categories that you roll up under that term dysfunction?
So if I can just say one more thing before we roll into that, Doug, it's very rare that we have a client coming to us saying, I suck at leading people. I need some help. And it's that double sales thing that we have to do at the front end, and really getting leaders to see that they're contributing to the issues, because we've really done this about face, where it used to be that employees complained about their leaders, but now it's leaders complain about their employees. And it's all of those complaints and getting leaders to shift so that they get a line of sight into, oh, if I was managing performance, if I was setting expectations in a particular way and creating a structured approach to leading, I might get more traction here, which is, of course, really empowering for people. And it can sound like a no-brainer to those who use that approach, but most of the client organizations that we work with, they don't have anything like that. They don't have a standardized approach for setting expectations and giving feedback and managing performance.
Well, and I love that, the way you've pictured that. And what I see is it is very consistent with what I do a lot of work around with clients, and that is, we have this weird tradition in modern business that when we need a supervisor, we look out on the floor and we pick our best producer to become the next supervisor. Ta-da! And that you set them sail on a little raft out in the ocean all by themselves, and they flop around. They flop around Truly. And try to figure it out. And maybe they've had good mentors, or maybe they had some role models along the way, and maybe they've got some ideas, or worse, they've got some wacky ideas about how they want to do it now that they're in charge. And those start evolving into what they probably are thinking is a leadership style or framework. And it's probably horrible. And they suffer through that enough, and production still continues, and they get honored by what? Another promotion. And now they're promoted up to the next level manager. And this happens two or three times. And then finally, in the bigger organizations, they say, well, when you get to this level, we're going to hire you a coach, or we're going to send you to some training. It's like, well, what about the last 10 years? You
know, exactly.
Now that I've learned how to do it wrong, and I've got all these bad habits that I now have to break free from, it's like,
you've
it's
got,
twice,
you've got
twice
all this,
the work.
You've got all this personnel collateral damage along the way.
Truly.
That, yeah. You know, the roadway is strewn with dead bodies of good people that you burn through because this guy was a clown, you know.
Yeah.
And no disrespect if you're listening and I just described your career path, but if you want to get real here and look in the mirror, I think we've all been guilty of that at some stage or form in our career. So,
and the sad thing about it, Doug, is that there's no reason that leaders need to flounder in that way and have to, you know, go through trial by fire, as it were, if they were onboarded into leading and taught to lead in a more professional way, with more respect for the profession of leadership. But as you say, you know, 10 years later, they give them training and what are they going to do at that point in time?
I know there's an evolution in the academic world when I don't swim deep in this, but I do try to stay on the periphery and pay attention. When I think of the big universities that have notable business schools, when you go back to my generation of business school, we didn't have a single class about leadership. Yeah. None. But now most of the curriculum that I'm aware of at least has some dive into the concept of defining leadership, explaining some of the dynamics, explaining some leadership theory. Maybe they might even go through a collage of all the leadership styles that have been known and talked about. And they try to encourage people that want to go into business to at least consider the notion of you're going to have to be leading people to make your business scale. And so there is at least a discussion happening, but then I think you get into what is really happening out in the real world once these people go and get that opportunity maybe to become a supervisor.
If we look at sort of the notion of dysfunction in organizations and in leadership approaches, is at the root of it, it's a developmental gap, right? It's because when the dysfunction emerges because the leaders don't have the skills, they haven't developed the skills and the ability. And a lot of the times we'll even say we encounter leaders who know what they, quote unquote, should be doing, but they don't do it. And so that's the challenge, I think, even when you get introduced to some of the leadership theory, because leadership is an experiential activity, right? We really develop up our ability as leaders through practice and the repetition of that practice. And practicing it correctly, of course, as opposed to incorrectly, which most of us that get booted into leadership roles do because we haven't been developed. And so when you think about some of those folks that come in, man, I talk about this a lot in the work that we do, is they think they're being a great great leader, or they think they're, you know, they're acting as the good leader and they believe they're doing all of the right things because they have this idea in their mind from, you know, the information that's come in. I got to keep my employees happy and I've got to be this to them and I've got to be that to them. And I, you know, and then all of a sudden they're not being effective leaders because they're so more focused on what their employees think of them or how they're being seen, the image of themselves as leaders, than what they're actually doing and assessing whether or not they're being effective and having the kind of impact they need to be having as a leader.
So how do you guys tackle the discussion about the difference between management and leadership? There's a chuckle here.
Who's going to tackle this one? Yeah. It's one of our favorite modules in our Leadership Foundation program, where leaders, when they hear about the differences in activities and the distribution of time and their just their behaviors, how they need to behave, what they need to delegate when they're leading, and what they don't delegate when they're managing, and they start looking at it from that perspective of, oh my God, I've been leading off the side of my desk. I haven't given any thought to plan or strategy or even building my team in a way that I want the team to be built. They're just looking at that, as you pointed out, Doug, they've gone from functionally sound as a manager into a leadership role where they continue all of the behaviors of management. And so we get into the competencies, into the defining. At the end of the day, it's really hard to define dysfunction when you don't have a really clear definition of what effective functioning looks like as a leader. And so oftentimes we have to start from there and define it for an organization of what they want their leadership competencies, what they want leadership behavior to look like, so that they can assess how they're doing relative to. And that's where we can go, oh, dysfunction, dysfunction, here. And the different types based on psychological type or based on their brain style, that each of the MBTI type, for example, will naturally gravitate to a different type of dysfunctional leadership style. So those are a couple of ways that we tackle that one.
I borrow a phrase to boil it down and kind of simplify it. I borrow a phrase from a friend of mine here in Houston that did a big study. It was one of those classic dive into big companies like Jim Collins did, study things. And my friend, his name's Dave Guerra. He wrote a book called Super Performing CEOs. And he, in the book, he, one of the CEOs he interviewed used the phrase, the difference between management and leadership is management is about process and leadership is about people.
Yep.
And it Absolutely. All started there, you know. Yeah. And I think that's really profound when you break it down and think about it. And what I tell my clients is, I've definitely known people that have made careers out of being professional managers. They've turned the screws, cracked the whip, hit the numbers, got things done. But inevitably, when you talk to the people that were associated with that work effort, there's not a lot of loyalty. There's not a lot of warm engagement for the experience, right? And probably the roster turned over multiple times in that tenure, whatever it might have been. But when you find somebody that has gone to work for a bona fide leader, it might be the same level of work in terms of, you know, significance and value to the company. But when you've got a real leader running it, then you start hearing about low turnover, high morale, high trust, all the fancy metrics people are trying to talk about today for high performing teams.
Yes.
Yeah. One of the things we see within that is that the leaders, even at the executive level, where there's some degree of resentment around having to spend too much time with their people. And so this is where we see it, and this abdication almost of the leadership aspect of their role is like, I'm too busy to talk to my people and spend time. They're fine. They know what they're doing. We trust them to do their job. I don't need to be involved in them. I remember very early on, even in my consulting career, where we talked about this notion of the higher up you go in the structure, the less and less time you spend on task and the more and more time you spend on people, as you've just talked about. And when we do that sort of measurement in our groups and with our clients around how much of your time are you spending really just focused on the people, and it's often in that 5 to 10% range. When it's, you know, at the executive level, it should almost be the opposite of that. It's their comfort zone, right? Their comfort zone is to stay with the task, to stay with the function, to not get involved with the people, to be really hands off. And then it's that question of, well, then what, how are you leading? Right? Are you leading? It's a verb, right? Are you leading? Are you out there ahead of your people? Are you just, you know, waiting? And, you know, it's so anyway, it's an interesting shift, but I do think, you know, to be reasonable, I know, and a lot of our clients, they also don't staff their leadership structure in a way that allows leaders to have the time. So, So the organizational design is one of the things we're talking about a lot with clients these days, is that, you know, the way they've set up their design and this notion that, well, we don't need to look at how much time do these roles require to really be effective leaders. Well, we just pile lots and lots of functional work. And when the leaders put their hands up and say, there's too much, I need resources, they say, no, you don't. You can keep getting it all done. And so the at the top of the organization all the way through, what's permeating is this idea of leadership is not something that is a valued activity in the organization, because again, as Anne said, you just do it off the side of your desk. That should be good enough.
Wow. That's very profound. And I tell you what, we're going to hang on to that idea, this kind of overload of the executive to the point of not even leading. We're going to hang on to that, and we're going to take a short commercial break, and we'll be right back after this message.
Business is all about solving complex problems as fast as you can create them. Become the best problem solver by leading others to greatness too. And the first step is going to DougThorpe.com. Doug Thorpe is known globally for coaching entrepreneurs and business leaders, improving their performance and the work output of everyone surrounding them. You can find health, wealth, and happiness by learning to lead others to health, wealth, and happiness. Go to DougThorpe.com now and order Doug's books or hire him to coach your managers. That's Doug, T-H-O-R-P-E.com.
All right, everyone. Hello, we're back. And we are talking about dysfunctional leadership and how do you find that and wring it out of your organization. And before we went on the break, we were talking a little bit about a really radical idea, when you think about it, of senior executives that don't connect with their people. They don't spend any time with their people. And Heather, you were speaking that. You mentioned it's a function of some organizational staffing at the top of the house on what prevents that. Talk a little bit more about that. What do you see as some of the general dynamics of how that ends up happening?
Think of one of our clients in particular, where this is a real challenge for them. And the way they talk about it is it's almost as though they don't really want to be executives. And so because, even though they're in executive roles, and because their comfort zone and what they're used to and how they're used to working is to be really busy with all of the work and be really involved with all the work that the business does. And you know, for them, when you look at making that transition is, what do they have to give up and to actually be executive leaders? But they're so afraid of giving up what they know and what they feel really competent at to move into this other place of just purely business and people leadership, right? Where they're spending more time talking strategy. I mean, in this particular organization, they don't even have a strategy, right? It's a very successful company. Don't get me wrong, but in spite of that, you know, it's like that, the notion that they have to move into doing something else and to talk about doing something else and delegating off and letting go of that control that they have in that space where they feel really comfortable, really competent, absolutely gets in the way. And so because of that, they won't hire people in underneath them who are competent that would allow them to do that. Nor do they look at their organization and say, you know, the team underneath them and say, is this team at the level I need it to be in order for me to be an effective executive? I think Anne made the comment too, is they don't have that frame of reference of what it looks like to be a functional leader or a functional executive in this case. And so because they don't have that model that they're trying to move towards, they just keep doing the same thing they've always done and complaining about the fact that, you know, they're so busy and they're always in meetings and, you know, complain. That's the indication to us always that there's dysfunction.
Yeah, I've seen very similar effects of that. And it goes hand in hand with what I said in the first half about the kind of the evolution of management. Top producer gets picked to be a supervisor. Supervisor gets promoted to manager. Manager makes it to director. Director makes it to VP. And pretty soon they're executive, whatever, maybe even the CEO. And there is that idea of hanging on to the comfort of what you know how to do. Yeah. And that's what keeps senior leaders bogged down in transactional delivery. That's what I call it. Yeah. And there, somebody pointed out to me one day, there was an irony here. We call these guys executive leaders, and the root of executive is execute. So you ought to be working on the details. And I'm like, okay, well, then let's go another direction here with that, because it's still the fact that it's undeniable, all companies really, but bigger ones in particular need bona fide leadership to take them where they want to go.
And just to add another dimension to it, that oftentimes we have to look at what needs leaders are satisfying in themselves. And so the need to feel productive and in control and competent and whatever that leader is used to feeling, that's what they're going to have to give up if they make the shift and stop doing and start being a leader. And they're not seeing that they're putting their personal agenda ahead of the agenda and the needs of the business. And we bring them around to, you know, getting a glimpse of that, because they have no line of sight into, you know, I'm being a little bit narcissistic here. And, you know, I just want to keep doing this because I like doing it. And I feel really powerful and really strong. And if I don't have anything on my desk, then my boss is going to come in and say, what are you doing? You're not doing anything. But if you're sitting and leaders need to think, they need time to strategize and think things through, but they can be really frightened that they're going to be labeled as unproductive. And that's a little bit of a shift that a whole senior leadership team will have to go through to carve out that time, not just to lead people, but to think about the business and what the business needs.
Yeah, I hear that. And there's a kind of a corollary to that I've witnessed and tried to help some people with. And that is that as somebody climbs the ladder and gets into that deeper, higher level of what is supposed to be executive leadership at a company, there is often an expectation from higher up that this person becomes a more strategic thinker. That's the word they use.
Yes.
Be a more strategic thinker. Well, immediately it's strategic thinker means you're not transactional anymore. You're not worrying about the day-to-day volume of production that's going out the door, but you're looking at what's supposed to be the bigger picture for the greater good, right? Okay. So that creates that discomfort, whether it's your point and the person not getting their own needs fulfilled in delivery of that, or they feel like if they abandon the transactional part, they're somehow shirking on the duty and not doing a good job. But all the while, they're being nudged to be more strategic.
Right.
And there's this big disconnect on, you know, well, what the hell does that mean?
It's interesting. One of our clients, I think, is navigating this exact scenario, and in the conversation where she took on a new role at the executive level. She was moving into her third year in the role, and really starting to feel like she was getting, you know, some traction. And when she was preparing for her performance review with her CEO boss, she said to me, "But I didn't do anything this year. Like, I didn't do any of this. My team did it all." And I said, "Exactly. That's proof that you've made another step into the role as an executive. Did you direct it? Did you tell them what they were to do and how they were to do it? Did you make sure that it was done in alignment with what you asked for?" And it's like, that's leading. But for her, it was like, how can I go into my performance review? I haven't done anything. And just that mindset of, you know, we're judging our work based on criteria that's no longer relevant because we don't have that, again, that new set of criteria that we're using that's driving our action and that's driving our ability to assess how effective we are in these more senior leadership level roles, right?
Yeah. I think we touched on in the first half of the show this idea of setting the leadership framework, deciding on values and purposes that the company may want to be about, or specifically the leadership team needs to be pursuing. Let's talk about that a minute. I've had occasion on multiple scenarios now to be invited to come help a company change their culture, okay? And it has 100% of the time for me anyway, it started with the senior leadership team saying, we've launched this analysis. We have identified the golden nuggets. Here are the five values that we want to shoot for, or here are the six words that we want our leadership to represent. And what I say to that is, that's great. That's certainly a place to start. You have to put some definition to it. But the immediate place it starts to fall apart when you disseminate that through the ranks, all your management team doesn't necessarily agree that those words mean the same thing. And so then you get into this, I'm going to show my age, it's a do loop of discussion about, well, what does empowerment really mean? Or what does integrity really mean? Well, you know, what does character really mean? What does learning really mean? And you're sitting there going, really, guys? But it's an important element of being able to implement these things that you want to do.
And in the modeling that we do with leaders, we go right into that definition of integrity. Here's what it looks like at the senior leadership level, at the leadership, at the managerial, at the supervisory. Here's what it doesn't look like. So, and here's how it's going to link to your performance management system so that people are given feedback and that the leaders and managers are expected to give feedback to that next level based on these behavioral indicators. Because without that, again, without that functional description, it's really hard with behavior, as you know, for a leader to say, that's not the way I want it. And of course, the employee always goes, well, you never told me exactly what it looked like. And we can pull out the paper and say, oh, yes, we did. Here it is right here. This is exactly it. And this is what it doesn't look like. And that takes some time for, and because we're always talking about time as a resource for leaders, because they don't actually carve out that time, and you never see a leader's to-do list where it says, think for 2 hours on strategy, you know, talk to five employees about, you know, this, that doesn't go onto their to-do list. That's an aside. But it really is required, especially when you're initiating a program like this, where everybody is moving toward high performance. We've defined exactly what high performance looks like, but the leaders have to be taught how to bring their next level along. Because without that, and without handholding, which is one of our core competencies, we hold leaders' hands until they get things up and running.
And as we define all that and try to get that turned on, so to speak, in an organization, then I do see the connection to move over to the systems. And the classic one that I always run head into most of the time is the methodology for annual assessment of employees. And 9 times out of 10, the assessment system doesn't match the values and principles that you've said you're going to work on for 364 days.
Yep.
And then 365 comes around and you present this assessment and everybody's going, really?
It's, I always find that the notion of the doing just an annual review, it's like, if you look at your review process or whatever you do from a performance management perspective, it's a core function of yourself as a leader, right? So the idea that you can only do it once a year and that, you know, that there's nothing that you're doing that sort of builds up and leads into it. It's, to me, we always say that the year end review is just to recap all of the other conversations. So you have a way of capturing it and planning the year forward, right? So it's more future looking than past looking. But the amount of resistance we get with clients, because we're always saying, you know, increase the frequency, shorten the amount of time you spend, make it really simplistic. If it's your values, just do it off of your values. If it's job function, you know, whatever, it pick something. But you need those performance conversations. And it, especially right now with more and more staff working virtually, it's sort of making that time, taking that time out to, you know, do a coaching check-in that, you know, every 2 weeks or once a month, where it's just a little bit more integrated in the way in which you work, as opposed to this thing that HR imposes upon you to do. And I think that's the unfortunate thing, is that we leaders still struggle to get comfortable with this idea that fundamentally leading performance is the core aspect of their job. It's not about the system. The system's there to support. But if it's not supporting, then figure out another way to be doing it and making it meaningful so that it ties back to the job, right? Like common sense, you know, to a degree here, right?
I've got a great story on that. I've got a colleague, a gentleman named Roger Ferguson. I met him. He actually came to work for me in my banking days and was a department manager underneath me, and as I was a division head, and he brought to me a program that he has subsequently tried to promote and advocate. He went on after our banking days, he went on to be a professional HR manager and did some global HR work at some big global brands. But as he retired from all that, he got focused back on this assessment system, and he calls it simply the Big Five. And it's a real neat principle. And to your point, Heather, what he advocates is once a month, every employee lists their 5 accomplishments and their understanding of the next 5 priorities, not goals, but just priorities of what they need to be working on. And the manager then is supposed to take that and have a short sit down, to your point again, a short sit down with the employee to say, congratulations on those 5 accomplishments. Good job. Great job. Maybe not so good a job. Wish you could have done more. Da, da, da. You have that feedback. Then you look at the 5 priorities and you say, yes, 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 no. Let's talk about number 4. Let's put something else in that slot for you. And now number 5, yes, that's okay. So those are your 5 marching orders for the new month. And now you go, that the employee leaves and goes to work. And you do that across the board. And when the new month comes around again, guess what? The 5 things that were priorities last month ought to be on your accomplishment list for the new month, yeah, right?
Exactly.
And if they're not, and they might not be, you know, have a discussion. Well, was there an interruption or did the project shift or what happened? You know, let's talk about that. And you just iterate that. And then if you want to have an annual merit award process, you got 60 data points to look at for every employee.
Absolutely.
And now you can make your decision on whatever scoring and ranking you want to do to award merit and bonus, et cetera. But you know what? That's a long story to get to this bottom line. He can't give that away. Companies look at it. And I've helped him. I've presented it to probably 36 of my clients. I haven't landed it anywhere. They all say, oh, that's too simple. That can't be good. It's not hard enough. I swear. That's the answer we're both getting. It's too hard. I mean, it's too simple. It can't be good.
Yeah, right. I think of a client of ours where we used to call their performance system. It was basically plan, do, review. And it's same premise, right? And what's nice about the frequency of once a month, we always say with the annual plans, you know, the process, leaders can never actually master having performance discussions. But mm-hmm. when you increase the frequency, it becomes transactional. And so they're looking for, I still think that there's so much resistance that we experience in leaders around managing performance. That, you know, it's like, despite all we know about the fact that, again, it's a fundamental aspect of being an effective leader is managing performance, setting the expectations, reviewing how they did, resetting, and again, repeating that process over and over again.
And well, go ahead. I was just thinking how much these types of leaders approach leadership in likely the same way they approach parenting, expecting their children to grow themselves, and all they have to do is tell them what to do and they should do it, without recognizing that you have human beings that you're trying to nurture along through these conversations. And if a leader doesn't hold their own value and see that giving time to an employee is a reward, if they don't hold that inside of themselves, they are less likely to think this is something that will engage my employee, which of course just ties into another system that's so critical in these days of not having enough people to work, that we have to engage them by being present to what employees might need. And part of what they need is approval, encouragement, training, and course correction when necessary. And the absence of that, just as in the absence of parenting, again, lends itself to dysfunction.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I know there's going to be extreme examples. One thing that came to mind for me is an executive I did some work with, and the company had done a major reorganization. And as I was talking to him, we got to talking about like this big five, or this notion of coaching your people and really having the good discussions about expectations and accountability. He shook his head and he said, in this reorg, I've been given 20 direct reports.
Oh my.
I don't have time to do that with these people. And I said, well, okay, hang on. My gut reaction would be to agree with you. That seems severe. I said, but let's do the math just a minute. I said, if you could invest, let's be bold, let's say 30 minutes a month, really focused on task. And I was thinking big five in the back of my mind. 30 minutes a month. Okay, that's 10 hours. Yes. But you got 40 hours in a week and four of those. And you're talking 10 hours of really solid management for those 20 people. Is that so hard? Is that so bad? And he kind of thought a minute and he said, yeah, I guess that is doable. And I said, I bet you spend a lot more time course correcting because you discover somebody's gone off on a tangent. And you've wasted a lot of time and resources while that direction needs to get reeled back in and back on course. But what if you proactively set that course at the start of every month and had this little rhythm of having these discussions? Then you could answer all the questions. And that's where I adopted the phrase for this model. You'll literally be on the same page. Yeah. So anyway.
Yeah. One of the things that we find is for a lot of our clients, and they're oriented, the dysfunction that they're working out of is permissiveness, as Anne said. It's like this absolute sort of abandonment of the notion that they're the ones that are in a position of authority, and they don't want to tell their employees. They don't, it's like they're so afraid that they're going to be categorized as micromanaging or authoritarian, that they skip the step of really defining and directing and telling, to always thinking, well, I've got to be coaching or facilitating, right? And I've got to let the employee decide, and I get to let the employee have more freedom. And so it's that interesting piece around, a lot of the times we're talking to our clients about more time up front, more time in the planning. You have to shift out of that, you know, sort of giving information without giving direction. So they'll say, you know, I need you to do such and such a task, but they won't put in the timeline, any of the parameters that the employees to work within. So again, not actually directing the performance as though the employee is in the best position or should, or has the authority to make those decisions. And then they're getting back work that's misaligned for that reason. And then they complain about the employee, or they, you know, have to put in extra time to fix it. But they, when we talk to them about shifting it and spending more time up front in the directing, it's this discomfort again that comes up. It's, well, what if they, again, what if they accuse me of micromanaging, or what if they, they're not going to like me, or they're going to get upset because I'm, you know, telling them how to do it. And it's amazing that leaders really, at least the ones that we work with, is like, they have no sense of the authority that they're entitled to exercise, and no, they don't feel comfortable with really exercising that authority. And so they, again, they hand it over, they leak it out to others and let their employees be the ones that are really leading them. And so that's part of the challenge that we see in trying to make some of these shifts in the organizations that we're working with.
And I'm guessing from your, did I hear you right? You had a psychotherapy practice for a while.
Yes.
Still,
yes,
do
I
or
did.
Not?
Yes, I do.
There's inevitably, I know in all of my coaching, and sometimes my clients, we chuckle about it. We'll get down a train of thought and we'll be discussing, and the client or myself will say, uh-oh, we better stop. This is starting to border on psychotherapy, right? And of course, you know, my own code of ethics doesn't allow me to go there, and I make that clear to my clients. But it's when you really get into the substance of leadership, there's definitely a mindset that has to be found.
Yes,
about role, responsibility, attitude, outlook, etc.
And it's one of the things that's quite unique to us, because Heather and I went through this whole process at the beginning of how to introduce emotions, because when we first started working together, emotional intelligence was just coming on the scene. It hadn't been around for very long. We had the competency model from Daniel Goleman that we were working with, but we were really tentative about it. Now we lead with it, because we know, having done this as long as we've done it, we know that we need to address the developmental needs of the person who is leading. And it's not that they're bad leaders, and they're more likely to characterize themselves as bad, or there's something neurotic about them. And it's like, no, you just haven't developed. And so you're compensating. And once they see that they're compensating, and that is really inefficient, to your point, Doug, that the inefficiency of letting people make mistakes by not telling them what exactly it is they're expected or what their goals are, that the leader ends up compensating for it. And getting the leader to start their own developmental process and feel empowered by doing that. And so it's not necessarily that we're analyzing them. We always do a personality assessment to see how their brain's organized and what their the emotional drivers of their behavior are, and how they're going to behave if they're self-protective. And we talk to them about that, and they very easily and quickly move into the language that we use. In fact, it's a bit of a relief to know, you know, I'm not neurotic, I'm just a ENTJ, or, you know,
yeah.
A performer, or, you know, it's I'm really okay, and I need to develop, and it's practical and tangible, that road they need to go down.
Well, before I let you ladies get away, there is one area I want to bring up that I do pretty frequently get asked about, this concept of managing up the organization. Leaders at all levels, inevitably, unless you're talking to the CEO or the chairman, they will describe some degree of frustration with the person or persons above them. And they want to ask, and the popular phrase is, I want to manage up the organization. I have a whole dissertation on that. I'm not gonna leave the witness here. How do you attack that in your work?
We talk about the fact that each of us as leaders, we create a gap because of our natural inherent leadership style, our strengths and capabilities, our work preferences. There's always going to be a gap that each leader above us is going to produce. So instead of, we don't talk about managing up, we just talk about leading into the gap. So if you see that gap, and that gap that your leader has is impacting you, it's having a bigger impact on you than it is on your leader. And so then it's your job to figure out, how do I lead into that? And so how do I help my leader to close the gap? And unfortunately, a lot of the times people will complain about their leaders as though their leaders should be able to do everything and they should be perfect. And so when we start talking about thinking about them as human beings and that have strengths and weaknesses, so then our job is to facilitate that process of, I've identified this gap or this issue here, what can I do? For example, if my leader is not good at planning, and I have that as a strength, how can I help my leader by, instead of coming to them and asking for a plan, saying, hey, I've done a first pass at a plan. Do you want to take a look at it and give me feedback and help me shape it further? So it's not so much trying to manage our leader, but more learning how to lead into that gap, which actually builds our skills as leaders in preparation for the next level as well.
I like that a lot. And if I may, I'm going to borrow that language because it actually fits perfectly with my answers to my people about that. I said I had my own dissertation on that. My position is exactly what you said, Heather. You don't manage up the organization. It's a definitional impossibility. So there are ways to use your influence to mitigate whatever that situation is. But I like your words a lot better. Just, you know, lead to that gap. And I think that that's exactly what we're up against with that.
And oftentimes senior leaders will assume that the next level leaders will automatically initiate and they'll want people to take more accountability. This happens in a number of our client organizations where the senior leaders are saying, no one's taking accountability. We really want them to step up and take initiative, but the next level doesn't even know what shared accountability or even the concept of shared organizational accountability looks like. And they have to be told what to do ahead of doing it. And that's putting it more in the context. Heather spoke more to that particular, but the context of leaders saying, you know, you can do this. You have I'm delegating the authority to you. When you see something, you can initiate around it. Can't necessarily make all the decisions, but you can, as Heather in her example pointed out, take that first step and bring it to me so that the gap is closed.
You know, that brings up another thought in my mind. The bigger the organization, what I do with a lot of my clients, I will ask the individual the question, do you have your own vision about what you and your department's team, segment, whatever, are supposed to be doing? Do you have your own vision? There's the company vision way up here, but have you crafted your own? And 9 times out of 10, they'll say, no, I'm waiting for guidance.
I know, right?
And I say, wrong. I say, wrong.
Truly. Can I do that?
And to bring home that point, I was coaching a young man a couple of years ago, and midway through our coaching engagement, and the company had contracted this because he was a high potential, supposedly. So halfway through our thing, he tells me, he said, hey, I'm on a short list for a VP job. And I said, well, good for you. What's it about? What are you thinking? Da, 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 da. And I told him, I said, why don't you build your own 100-day plan for what you're going to do the minute you walk in the door of that job? And he said, I'm not sure I know everything I need to know about it. I said, but how much do you know? And he said, I know a lot. And I said, okay, use what you got. Build yourself a 100-day plan about how that would work. So he got busy. And the next time I talked to him, he said, I got my plan done. I said, well, do you want to review it or anything? So we talked about it. Then the next session after that, he showed up. And as soon as I turned on the screen, he had this huge smile. He said, guess what? I got the job. And I said, no, that was fast. And what happened? He said, well, this VP job reports to the COO of our company. I was interviewing with the COO and I took my little plan with me and I laid it out on the table and I showed him what I would do. And the COO said, holy crap, pick that up, come with me. And they walked into the CEO's office next door and it was like, hey, George, look what so-and-so has here. This is our 100-day plan we've been looking for. You know, that new VP job we want. We found our guy. And it was done, And so I told him, I said, there you go. You created the vision. And there was talk in the company of a transformational change. They wanted to take this particular unit through. And he addressed all that in his plan. Beautiful. And put a bow on it and picked right off the shelf, you know, to be the guy. So it's that advanced thinking of, you know, don't wait on that directive, take the initiative. You know, you say you don't know what they want you to do. Well, if you know the company and if you know the work, build a plan, go evangelize it. And if it needs adjusting, so what? You know, that's fine. You know, let them calibrate it to the greater good and everybody will be better off for it.
Yeah, one of the things we often talk about with our clients is the notion of the 80% rule, right? Is that because they do the same thing, right? It's like, well, I'm not sure I'm going to get it exactly right. It's like, well, just get it 80% of the way there, because 80% of the way there is better than 0% of the way there and waiting and being stuck in that place of following when nobody's leading. Right. And that's the situation. If the tier above you isn't necessarily being directive and defining, they're not giving you anything to follow. So it really is incumbent upon you to take the initiative to lead and lead up into that gap. But it's that fear again. We get stopped by that fear. Well, what if I get it wrong? What if I don't have all the information, that story that starts to run through our brains that keeps us from actually, again, stepping into our empowering ourselves and stepping into our power to, you know, to put that plan together. So Doug, I thought that was a great example of that. You know, really stepping in and doing it, and just the confidence of having gone through that exercise before he went into the interview process also would have done so much for him, right?
Absolutely. Well, ladies, I think we're up on time for this episode. This has been a real joy and a pleasure. Any kind of closing thoughts that you can share to sort of wrap all this up?
Go ahead, Heather.
Well, I'm going to bring it back around to dysfunction, because of course we started off talking about dysfunction, and that's our favorite thing always to talk about. And it's the conversation around dysfunction is that it is natural, it is normal, it is to be expected in organizations. And the most important thing that leaders can do is actually talk about it, as opposed to thinking it's this thing that we have to avoid. It's the elephant in the room that nobody's allowed to comment on, because every time we go into organizations and we start to talk about the dysfunction and name it, it actually allows us to do something and move towards action to dismantling it.
I like that. It's kind of a freeing, cleansing sort of exercise. Yeah. Ann, you had something?
Yeah. I just wanted to, the notion that we can just show up and lead, and that creates so much anxiety, especially for young leaders, where they're so anxious about getting it right. And it's one of the reasons we decided to write our how-to in our book, So You Think You Can Lead, because in your example, Doug, you really highlighted somebody doesn't know what they don't know, you see, and he didn't even think that was something that would impress his bosses or he might do. And you gave him the idea that is something that one can do, and he did it. And when leaders see what it takes and how their emotions can get in the way of them being effective leaders, it really having a concrete plan for leading and what to do in what situation can alleviate a lot of that distress and anxiety about just knowing how to lead and knowing how to be with their people.
I like it. That is so very true. The whole idea of kind of getting paralyzed because you don't know what you don't know needs to just get put on a shelf, and you've got to refocus on what you do know and move forward with that. And like I said, try to create your own vision of what you need to do. When I talk to individual leaders about their own vision for their work, what I remind them of or encourage them to consider is that becomes their foundation for how to operate. And then when things start flying at them, if they've locked in on that vision of what they want to do and know they can do, the answers to new questions or challenges become so much easier to determine, because this curveball that just got thrown at you, either it can help your cause move forward or it's going to take it, you know, backwards, and you can make a much quicker, more sound decision about what you're going to do in that moment if you know what your vision is. But if you're waiting on direction and purpose and standard, you know, it's you don't know what to do with those questions when they show up. So, well, ladies, this has been a real joy. What is the best way people can find you and get a hold of you if they're looking?
So our website, dranitzaris-hilliard.com, has all the information about our books and our podcast and the work that we do. And our email addresses are there as well to contact us.
We'll have all that in the show notes, folks. And by the way, if you're listening to this on your favorite audio channel, don't forget, we've got a video over on my YouTube channel, Leadership Powered by Common Sense. And you can see the video and enjoy the smiles on the faces of the ladies that have shared with us today. And again, thank you, Anne and Heather, for all your hard work and the great things you do.
Great, Doug. Thank you so much for having us. It's been a pleasure.
You bet. You bet.
Thanks, Doug.
So, folks, we're going to sign off and say goodbye. This is another episode of Leadership Powered by Common Sense. It's been a pleasure visiting with you, and hope to see you again soon. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Leadership Powered by Common Sense, hosted by Doug Thorpe. If you would like to know more about the coaching and advisory services he provides, visit DougThorpe.com.